Nobody owns life, but anybody who can pick up a cereal bowl owns death.
I'm Chelsea.
And I'm Ashley. And this is Serial Killers Elite.
Today we will be covering a suspected serial killer, David Parker Ray, also known as the Toy Box Killer.
David got his name from his use of soundproof trailer he called the Toy Box. This trailer was used to rape, torture, and possibly kill 60-plus women.
And from what I read, this could also be upwards of 100 women. David was born November 6, 1939 in Berlin, New Mexico, to father Cecil and mother Nettie. He was named after his uncle David, who was accidentally shot in the heart by his own brother at 13 years old, all because his grandmother believed he was a reincarnation of her son.
With what seems to be reoccurring theme in serial killers, David didn't have a great childhood. His father, an alcoholic, was very abusive to him, his sister, and even his mother. At the age of 10, his father often left for Albuquerque, leaving David and his sister Peggy with his mother.
Not too long after his father left, Cecil and Nettie got a divorce. Nettie decided to move in with her parents and ship the kids off to live with their paternal grandparents, Ethan and Dolly Ray. They lived with their grandparents for about 6 years, and within those 6 years, they barely saw their parents. Cecil stopped by twice and Nettie only a handful of times. Their paternal grandparents were very neglectful, and Ethan was also very strict. When his rules weren't met, he would resort to physical punishment of the children.
At the age of 12, David started setting off homemade bombs in the woods behind his grandparents' house. When he was 13, he was gifted a Cushman pacemaker motor scooter from his grandparents. This was a pivotal moment for David as he discovered his knack for automotive mechanics, which would serve him well as he grew up.
David went to Mountaineer High School in Mountaineer, New Mexico, and was often bullied during high school due to his grandfather's strict dress code, along with how shy and awkward he was with women. He was so shy, in fact, that his first date wasn't even until he was 18 years old. It is believed that it was around this time that David not only started abusing drugs and alcohol, but also started to fantasize about raping and torturing women.
These fantasies are believed to have stemmed somewhat from the neglect of his grandparents inflicted on him. And this.
Yeah. You butchered that sentence.
Yeah, I know.
Bibbidi boppity back up.
I can't even say Sato.
Reread the first sentence and it's sadomasochistic.
Okay. These fantasies are to believe. How do you say that word again? I'm still stuck on that word. You know what? You just say this sentence.
Okay. These fantasies are believed to stem somewhat from the. Wow.
This sentence just should not.
This sentence sucks dick. Okay. These fantasies are believed to stem somewhat from the neglect that his grandfather gave. I can't even finish it without laughing now. Woo. These fantasies are believed to stem somewhat from the neglect that his grandparents inflicted on him and the sadomasochistic magazines his father would bring him growing up on the food. I was doing so good.
On the food. Have you ever heard of foo noodle?
Yeah, nope. Oh my god. Okay. One more time. We got this. These fantasies are believed to stem somewhat from the neglect that his grandparents inflicted on him and the sadomasochistic magazines his father would bring him growing up on the few occasions he actually visited.
One of his first fantasies was centered around using broken bottles on women. And by the age of 15, he had already fashioned together his first dungeon that consisted of broken bottles and a hangman's noose hanging from a tree. His sister even found drawings he had drawn of women being gagged and bound.
After high school, David worked as an auto mechanic and was married to his first of many wives by 1959. He had his first kid, a son by the name of David Jr., by 1960, shortly after he joined the Army and was stationed in Korea. He ended up filing for divorce shortly after his son's birth due to his wife leaving the child home alone while she went out and partied. He had his son live with his grandparents until he was honorably discharged from the military.
By 1962, David had remarried to his second of four wives, but was divorced again within 3 months. In 1966, David married Glinda Bardeen, whom he would remain married to for nearly 15 years. Together in 1969, they had a daughter named Glenda Jean Ray, who went by the name of Jessie Ray. In 1997, David met and shortly after, I'm just going to back right up there.
You always get hung up on this sentence.
In 1997, David met and shortly after meeting, God, I sound like a robot.
You do. Every time I edit this podcast, I crack up because you pause in the most weird ass places.
In 1997, David met and shortly after meeting, started dating Cindy Hendy, who was a whopping 20 years younger than him at the time.
Sexy. It is believed very sexy. That's like dating my dad. Yeah.
I get it, baby.
I mean, he's a little older than that, but still, that's the concept I have in my head when they're 20 years older.
Right.
I can do 10. 15. 15 for me personally is really pushing it. 20 is a no-go.
20 is a little old.
Yeah. So it is believed that David's potential killing spree began sometime in the early 1950s, with his first recording in his journals being around 1955. This first journal entry talked about how at 15, he reenacted a rape with a 15-year-old girl, and she supposedly liked it. Within a year of his first journal entry, at the age of 16, David had already had his first rape victim. A 16-year-old girl that ended up dying from what they believed to be blood loss. Can we just pause there? What the fuck happened to that 16-year-old girl? Like, how did he not get in trouble for that?
I don't think he knew where the body was or, like, told them where the body was.
Oh, so she was just never found.
Yeah. The journals that kept David throughout his life were very... Oh, God.
Did you catch what you said?
I had to reread that like four times in my head, and I was like, I didn't even say it wrong.
Are you dyslexic?
Yes, I am.
Oh, my gosh. It is. When you're sick and have had wine, it is really obvious.
The journals that David kept throughout his life were very detailed and would describe not only his day-to-day activities, but also the woman he held, where he kept them, and how he rated his women. He had a scale from 1 to 3 he would rate them on, 1 being hot as fuck, and 3 being garbage.
Obviously, I'm a 3.
Yeah, me too. I could probably fall on a high 4.
Oh, for sure. I'm pushing the 5 and 6 scale.
On a good day.
Like, that's hot, messy garbage is what it is. Been outside for a hot minute. The raccoons have been through it. Like, Morbid actually had someone write in that had dated Jessie Ray off and on throughout his life. He described David as very quiet, and the family is extremely nice and willing to give you the shirt off their own back. He even went on to explain that he had been left alone at their house once while they had someone locked in the toy box. He was at the house with Jessie while David was at work. Jessie ended up leaving the house for some reason and told him that they had agreed to let a homeless guy stay in the shed out back, so to not be alarmed if he heard anything unusual, as the guy was schizophrenic and unsafe. I honestly couldn't imagine looking back on something like that and knowing that I could have saved or changed the lives of multiple women had I saw the signs. That's a lot of guilt to hold, knowing that you were there and could have potentially changed the lives of so many people. He shouldn't hate himself for any of it by any means, because he had no clue. He was young. They gave him absolutely no reason.
Right. Except for just a creepy fucking trailer, you know, that a homeless schizophrenic man was staying in.
And I do want to point out that if anyone has listened to the tape recording that David made, and that is up on YouTube, if anybody wants to listen to it, he does mention the section about his dogs. And the guy that emailed Morbid said that he has no recollection of David ever owning any dogs.
But what if the dogs were locked up in the trailer?
You would have heard them barking, though.
You never know. You know what I'm saying? It was soundproof.
True, but you're still going to have to take them out at some point. Like, there's going to be dog poop in the yard. Like, you know what I mean?
Speaking of Jessie, let's get some background on her. As mentioned before, she is David's daughter. She was introduced to sexual... blah, blah, blah. Speaking of Jessie,
I'm just literally not editing this entire episode. It's staying like this.
There you go. That's okay. The fails of podcasters. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Jessie, let's get some background on her. As mentioned before, she is David's daughter. She was introduced to violent sexual behavior at a very young age, thanks to her father, which probably plays a huge part in Jessie being an accomplice to her father. On many occasions, she would help lure women in for David and pick women she thought was best for him / easy targets. Jessie was only 32 when she was arrested for helping her father kidnap and torture women. She pleaded no content. She pleaded no contest to the kidnapping charges, as she was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison with 5 years of parole. She did end up assisting her father in the end. In 1986, she had tried to call the police and tell them everything that her father was doing, but despite them investigating her claims, that they still chalked it up to be an upset daughter. Lastly, and rather disturbingly, Jessie was a whopping 7 years younger than Cindy Hendy, David's last girlfriend and yet another accomplice.
Before meeting and dating David, Cindy had a rather fucked up childhood. She was born on February 6th of 1960 in Washington. She was sexually and mentally abused growing up and was even forced out of her house at the ripe old age of 12. The reason, you ask? For confronting her mother about her stepfather raping her. By the age of 16, Cindy had already had a child, a little girl. We couldn't find much as to what happened to Cindy's little girl, though. As previously mentioned, Cindy met David in 1997, and they moved in together by 1999. Cindy was 39 years old when she got arrested for helping David, and she agreed to cooperate with the police to avoid a life sentence. She did get sentenced to 36 years, but only ended up serving 20 of those, as she was released on July 15th of 2019, which at this time is less than a year ago, and she was 56 years old.
The last accomplice that we are going to cover in today's episode, and Dennis Roy, hold on. I fucked that up.
Dude, you butchered the last paragraph, but that's okay. I still love you.
You know, fuck your mom. The last accomplice. You know, you would never do this with anyone else.
Exactly.
The last accomplice that we are going to cover in today's episode is Dennis Roy Yancey. Yancey was one of David's followers as he grew up right in Truth or Consequences. What are you laughing at?
as he grew up, and it's supposed to be and.
You know what?
You make the most subtle ass changes, and you like add in a random word, or you like skip one, or you just replace it, and it's fucking great.
You know what? I don't like your notes, okay?
I do speak very weird. Everyone says so. Like, the way I form my sentences is really confusing to people.
My brain does not work that way.
Your brain does not compute.
The last accomplice that we are going to follow in today's episode is Dennis Roy Yancey. What are you laughing at?
I'm so sorry.
This is not funny.
It's cover, not follow.
You know what? Looking at the sentence below it that says follower. Okay.
Oh my god, we are struggling so hard today. Okay, I'm good.
I don't like your attitude. I feel like you're judging me.
I'm not judging you. I think this is fantastic. Which is why I don't want to edit this episode now.
The last accomplice that we are going to cover in today's episode is Dennis Roy Yancey. Yancey was one of David's followers, and he grew up right in Truth or Consequences. Yancey was arrested on April 9th at age 27 for the murder and kidnapping of Marie B. Parker, 22. Marie was his ex-girlfriend and a victim of David Parker Ray. It was after David... Are you laughing at me again?
No, I'm being very stoic right now.
Right. I can hear you. Okay.
I'm just trying to keep it together from all the previous mistakes. Okay, I'm sorry.
It was after David had raped and tortured Marie that Dennis strangled her to death. He was only ever sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. Despite everything that Dennis knew, he never testified against David, as he received an anonymous note while in prison stating only rats die in prison. This note, while it isn't proven, is believed to be from David.
I still get so heated over the fact that he was only ever sentenced to 2.5 years in prison, despite the fact that he freaking strangled somebody to death. Still pisses me off.
Him and Cindy Hindy got really, really good, like, plea deals. I'm sorry, but...
To be fair.
They didn't get anything.
Cindy got more than he fucking did. 2.5 years.
Cindy had a lot more to do with it than I think she plays.
Oh, for sure.
Absolutely. My wine. I'm done. Throwing in the towel. Fuck.
That's a literal and figurative statement at this moment in time.
What?
You're throwing in the towel?
Yeah, I'm throwing in the towel. Oh, yeah, because I would be using a towel to clean it up.
Good job. Except you're not cleaning it up, are you?
Nope. It's not very wet. It was white wine on white carpet. So...
Before we get into talking about David's victims or the toy box itself, here are a few interesting facts about David and his tortures slash killings. In the very beginning, his journals state that he had help from someone named Shirley. It's widely believed that Shirley was friends with most of the victims she lured in for David, as it made for easy targets. He would often refer to his victims as packages, which I'm sure was a way to dehumanize them in his eyes. When David was done torturing his victims, whom he often kept for months at a time, he would use a cocktail of drugs to cause amnesia and memory loss and play with their minds for about 3 days until he was certain they wouldn't remember enough to cause him trouble. The cocktail of drugs he used was a mixture of sodium pentothal and phenobarbital. These are rapid onset, short-acting general anesthetics.
So, Let's go on and talk about David's victims. Billy Serez, he was David's business partner. He was murdered with a gunshot wound to the back of the head. He was one of David's victims. And it was, he was... Just... Fuck me.
The alcohol is killing us tonight.
No more drinking or podcasts.
Bullshit. This is way more fun.
Oh gosh, I just did something.
What?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? What'd you do?
Never mind, I got it.
Oh my god. You deleted the notes again, didn't you?
I can't delete them. They're on your end.
Yeah, but you can delete them off your screen.
I did. I took them off my screen.
Fucking called it.
Okay. So, let's talk about David's victims. What the fuck is going on? It just keeps going away off my screen. Like, slam, bam, and thank you, ma'am. I'm done.
Oh, my God.
Just one of those fucking days.
Can't believe.
I wish it was Monday so I could blame it on that, but it's definitely not.
Definitely Tuesday.
Let's talk about David's victims, finally. You know, like 20 minutes later. Billy Soraz. He was David's business partner. He was murdered with a gunshot wound to the back of the head. He was one of David's victims. And he was the only body to ever be recognized.
Recovered.
We should just throw this whole episode in the trash.
I 100% agree, except it's really entertaining.
What?
I thought I would 100% agree, except it's really entertaining.
I'm dancing in the corner of my room.
You should have seen the hand motions I was making above my head while I was reading the last paragraph. I'm like sitting in my recliner all leaned back and my hands are like dancing above me while I'm talking. That's how I know I've had too much alcohol.
I'm like doing like the hang loose sign, like shaking my hands around while reading. I didn't eat supper and I had a little under half a bottle of wine.
Oh so. Dear God, I'd be shit-faced. No wonder you're replacing words and all sorts of shit.
What?
No wonder you're replacing words and all sorts of shit. Oh my god. Alright, come on. Finish your shit. Get your shit together. Get it all together.
I can't do that.
And then put it in a backpack, take it down to the shit store and sell it.
It's cool. I'm still here.
Didn't die?
I didn't die yet.
Damn.
Sorry. Can't have my life now.
Darn. Oh, I don't want the kids and things.
Okay. Billy Soraz. He was David's business partner. He was murdered with a gunshot wound to the back of the head. He was one of David's victims. And he was the only body to ever be recovered. He was found floating in the lake. Angelica Montano came forward after David's arrest, stating that she had been drugged and raped after going to his house and asking if she could borrow a cake mix. He left her on the side of the road in the desert where she was found by police. Her report had never been followed up.
That is so fucked up. How do you not follow up on a rape report? So it was March. Yeah, we're going to wait till my yawn's gone. Okay. It was March 19th, 1999, when David Parker Ray kidnapped Cynthia Vigil, who would end up being his last victim. She was hooking in a parking lot in Albuquerque, New Mexico. David used the ruse of an undercover cop and pretended to arrest her for solicitation of sex work. From there, David brought her back to the infamous toy box, where he then chained her to the gynecologist table and played his cassette tape that he played for every victim. This cassette is very gruesome and goes into explicit detail of what they are to expect from David and what he expects of them. It's a whopping 50 minutes long. After playing her the tape, David then raped and tortured Cynthia with the help of his girlfriend at the time, Cindy Hindy. He held Cynthia for 3 days before she was able to escape. She managed to do so because Hindy left the keys on a coffee table while she left the room to talk on the phone. Now, at this point, I'm pretty sure I read that she was only restrained by the metal collar around her neck.
Yeah, because they thought that she was too weak to even try to get away.
But then how the fuck did she still have the collar around her neck when she got to the neighbors?
She still had the collar on her neck. Like, it wasn't attached to anything.
Then how was she restrained? What did she need the key for?
To let herself loose from the chain.
What chain?
That was attached to the lock or whatever.
I think it was attached to the wall.
What?
So I think the chain must have been attached to the wall.
Yeah. Okay. It was attached to the wall or like the end of the table or something. And she had to unhook that one. But the restraints on her legs and arms weren't attached because they figured that she was too weak to try to get away because they hadn't been beating her or anything.
That's what I thought, but then I kept reading and I got confuzzled. So I confuzzled myself. Anyways, now at this point, Cynthia was only restrained by the metal collar around her neck. She was able to reach her foot out and pull the coffee table close enough to get the keys. Midway into pushing the coffee table back into place, Hindy came back into the room and saw what was happening. She tried to get the keys from Cynthia. However, Cynthia managed to get herself free and stab Hindy in the neck with an ice pick. At this point, Cynthia was able to run out of the trailer into the neighbors to have them call the police. She showed up at the neighbors nude with chains and a collar around her neck. After the police showed up and started searching the neighborhood, they found David and Cindy driving up and down the streets in town looking for Cynthia. When questioned, they told police that they were trying to help Cynthia because she had a meth addiction and they had her chained up to help her with the withdrawals. The police took Cynthia to the hospital right away, where they had to cut off the collar that was around her neck. She then sat in the hospital room and just kept repeating to herself, "They can't get me. I'm safe here. They can't get me."
When they cut her collar off, she threw it across the room.
Yeah, that's like, that had to be so like freeing and also just like terrifying. You know what I mean? Like terrifying because like it's a reminder sitting on the other side of the room of what just happened to you, but also really freeing to have it off of you and be like, okay, I'm safe now.
Right. And like when they went to sentence him, she was there for it. And she like lost her shit in the courtroom and started like screaming at him.
I would too. Like, I could not imagine going through what she went through.
I don't think I would want to see him survive. Yeah, I don't think I would want to see him face to face.
I mean, I've seen pictures. That's enough for me. That is close enough for me.
Right?
Like, and I give her so many fucking props for kicking ass at life after going through what the fuck she went through.
Right. So inside the toy box, he had a gynecologist table in the middle and a mirror mounted to the ceiling so that when he took the women, they would have to watch all the horrible shit that had to be done to them. I just find that petrifying.
It's sick. And it is a whole other level of mind-fucking someone.
Right?
Like, you can't, you have to close your eyes to get away from it. And yet, I'm pretty sure he probably would not let you do so.
Right. Well, and then you would have to, if he even told you, like, I said, keep your eyes open. Like, even though you wanted to, like, so bad, you would still be like, if I don't, will he kill me?
Exactly. And I'm probably at that point going to be like, okay, I'm just going to do whatever he wants because I don't want to fucking die today.
Right. I want to get out of here alive.
Right.
There's numerous sex toys littered all over the floor. He made a voice recording in 1993. That's what Ashley was talking about. That was 50 minutes long. But it let the women know what they could expect when he was like raping them and all of what they would endure through that whole time. And he would play it on repeat. So it would just continuously play. It's just nasty. And if you ever listen to it, like just the beginning part, like gives you the chills. It's just
gives you the heebie-jeebies. To the entire thing. You didn't, did you? You only listened to 10 minutes.
Yeah, because it was just fucking nasty.
Yeah, I listened to the entire thing, and it was so fucking hard to listen to. So fucking
like,
hard.
The beginning is like, hey there, bitch. Like, excuse me?
Yeah. Like, he just... The way he talks to them is, like, so demeaning.
Right.
Oh, I'm sure you think that you're gonna, you know, I'm sure you're gonna try and get out of here and, you know, you'll figure it out that you can't. Like, it's impossible. Many before you have tried and they haven't succeeded. So, like, basically, don't try.
And the voice that he says it in, like, he has a weird, okay, his voice is like a twang, like Texas, Southern draw. And it just makes it even more fucking creepy.
It does. It really does. No offense to anyone with that accent, but just hearing that tape and hearing the sick things being said with that accent just makes it so much creepier.
It reminds me of an old, like, horror movie.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
There was a contraption that was made to immobilize the victims and cause them to be bent over so him and his accomplice could rape them. Which is absolutely disgusting.
Which he would do during parties, of which his friends would come over and do the raping with him. Fucking mind blown.
He would spray pheromones, too, to have his supposable dogs rape them.
That's what we were talking about earlier. He would spray like a breeding scent on her, like whoever the victim was. Sorry. And then he literally in the audio goes on for probably a good 5 to 10 minutes explaining the entire process with his dog in detail.
It's just gross.
Fucking, it's animal abuse right along with human abuse.
This sick fuck just shouldn't have been born.
Nope, I'm with you.
He had diagrams. What was that?
So he's fucking disgusting.
Yeah, he is. He had diagrams all over the walls to help show him how to inflict pain to his victims. Police also found a videotape from 1996 that showed David and his girlfriend raping and torturing a woman. He had Satan's Den in the toy box written on the walls of the toy box.
I wonder why Satan's Den didn't take off more. You know what I mean? Like, why did the toy box click before Satan's Den? Because in my opinion, he's fucking Satan. Like, he is the spawn of fucking Satan.
I feel like if a news anchor or a news station would put Satan's Den out, like, on television, I feel like it would give them a bad rating.
Probably, because it probably would just, like, not go over well with a lot of people.
Right. So I feel like that could have been a lot of it on why they went with the toy box killer instead.
Yeah.
He kept two boxes in the trailer made out of wood, almost like a coffin, to keep two women at the same time. He would take turns torturing the women, leaving one in their box, to only hear the screams of the other women being tortured. I would be, like, so afraid of the dark in small spaces after that.
That would almost instantaneously make me claustrophobic and terrified of the dark.
I would rather be dead.
Yeah. Honestly, like, if you survived that and he used, you know, the drug concoction we talked about to kind of quote-unquote wipe your memory, but not really, you know, he kind of sort of gives them a blessing at the end of that by doing that, because right. They don't really remember what happened. Like, I'm sure they know something happened, and they probably know, you know, something fucked up happened, but I guess I don't really know if it would be better or worse knowing exactly what it was. Because I don't know that I'd want to live after that. I really don't.
I wouldn't want to. What kind of a life would you live after that? Sheltered and afraid of the world?
Exactly. I would trust nobody after that. Absolutely fucking no one. There's no way that would...
You couldn't trust anyone.
Nope. Because, especially for, like, Cynthia, he fucking posed as a cop.
Right. The, like, people that are supposed to be protecting you. He was actually... He was a state parks guy. I think those are, like, fish, game, and parks.
Wow. It's game, fish, and parks.
Whatever. Same smell.
You and your dyslexia over here.
That's what he was. So he had, like, a uniform and everything.
Oh, that just pisses me off. He's getting bad names, dude.
One of the victims was picked up and dropped off at home by David.
Oh, fuck?
Yeah. He picked her up off the side of the road with finger quotes, picked her up off the side of the road and looked high and, like, disordered. And he picked her up, dropped her off at home, and her husband did not want her back in the house because he thought that she was out cheating when she was being raped and abused by David,
the cop that dropped her off. That's the one that also got a divorce, right? Because he didn't believe her. God, yeah. I hope to God he feels like a fucking prick.
Right. So, like, this whole time, he is posing as a cop, but he really had authority like that.
Ugh, I hate him. He got eaten.
And the federal state task force collected over 1,000 pieces of evidence and excavated around his property.
I'm just saying, he fucking got off so easy. He died. Like, what was it? A year after he was sentenced?
He was just the day he was moved to be starting his conviction, he died of a heart attack. So the same day. So he literally got away with murder.
Pretty much, because he had to spend, he was in jail for a year, because that was how long it took for the trial and everything, and he was behind bars for that. But then, like, the day he was fucking sentenced, he gets to fucking die of a heart attack? No. Fuck you, asshole. You deserve to rot in prison.
Right.
Like, the entire rest of your humanly life.
They also never found any of the bodies of the women.
Yeah. I don't really think he killed too many of them, to be honest. I really don't.
I think he did.
I truly don't. I don't think he killed that many. I think he mostly, because he says in his audio that he doesn't like to kill people unless absolutely necessary. So I really don't think he killed too many of them. I think he let most of them go.
Do you think that strong dose of drugs really made them forget this whole thing?
I don't think they forgot the whole thing, but I think that what they do remember is enough for them to not come forward.
And he did say that he learned over this like whole thing going on. He told Cindy Hindy to empty the body cavity and stuff them with rocks before disposing the bodies.
That's so fucking disgusting.
Well, if you think about it, I couldn't figure out why that would be something that he learned. Well, his first victim floated.
Yeah. Well, that and like tying rocks to the victim isn't going to do much because eventually over time, the string is going to like, you know, rot away.
Right.
And so emptying the body cavity and filling it up with rocks is not to praise a serial killer, but ingenious.
Right.
Because the skin can rot away, but the rocks are more than likely at that point going to be in there for good.
Right. Like, you ever wondered what he did with the like guts and stuff? Like, did he eat them?
Bet you he fed it to his dogs.
But what if he didn't have dogs, like that guy said? Where did he dispose of them?
Maybe just out in the wilderness so that, like, you know, whatever could go clean it up. Since he did work for the state park.
That's true.
And that, my friends, is a motherfucking wrap.